Hey everybody, what's up? Chad Wesley Smith here for the Jug Life Podcast. On today's episode, Max and I talk about how we kind of arrived at our current coaching philosophies, sort of the steps and stages along the way as our development from young athletes to the coaches you know now, and how our philosophies were developed, who helped develop them, what, you know, experiences in our life got us to where we are now. Today's episode is brought to you by Roan. If you want great looking clothing for any occasion, in the gym, on the golf course, at work, whatever it is, Roan has got you covered. You know, they first sponsored the podcast several months ago. They sent me a gift card to get some stuff. And since then, I've made several orders all on my own, paying for the clothes myself because I like it so much. Whether it's like this, the Peak Polo, the Sentry Tank, all kinds of great shorts, Guru shorts, Mako shorts. I've got, you know, bathing suits from them, all sorts of stuff. You can visit roan.com and use Jug Life for 20% off from them. Great company. If you're interested in online coaching, Juggernaut apparel, or our books, visit jtsstrength.com. And of course, make sure to like the video, subscribe to the channel, share it with your friends, go on iTunes, leave us a 5-star review on the Jug Life podcast. Enjoy the episode.
Coming to you from Orange County, California, this is the Jug Life Podcast with Max Ada and Chad Wesley Smith.
What is up, buddy? How you doing?
I'm doing pretty well, yeah.
Fresh off the plane from Lima, Peru.
I don't know if the word fresh would describe the way I got off the plane from Peru, but yeah.
Do you still have your Machu Picchu calf pump going on?
They're still sore. My left leg is noticeably more sore than my right, which I think is probably related to being, you know, super crooked or like a hip shift, but you definitely notice after about 1,000 steps that you're not quite even there.
And it was a great day for Shakesha.
Yeah,
down there.
Yeah, Shakesha killed it. Had an awesome day, 5 for 6. Took the gold in the snatch against Lady Soleil from Colombia, which was awesome. And then, you know, just finally had one of those, like, really good 5 for 6 meets that she's needed to have. And, you know, ended with a 241 total, which is a PR, competition PR snatch, comp PR clean and jerk, lifetime PR clean and jerk as well. And, you know, it was just, like, came to win and did everything she could.
And Roby-wise, it seems pretty... You know, she's only ninth on that panel list. It does seem pretty solid.
Yeah, she's only ninth on the list, but it puts her in a good spot because she's like, you know, the 76s are kind of up in the air for Pan Ams. My assumption is that Kate and I may pass going to Pan Ams, which would put us as the number 176. So, you know, we're also at 241, which gives us a little bit of an edge against Rogers if she just decides to switch to 76. We'd be ahead of her, so she'd have to, you know, repeat a good performance and do like a 242 to get ahead of us. So it's a good overall position to be in for her.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, I'm excited for AO in a couple of weeks. That's going to be a very fun meet.
Yeah, a lot of people going.
So what I want to talk about today, and something we get asked, you know, my email's been blowing up. A lot of people have been asking about my skincare routine. But
in between those emails, what other emails are you getting?
that they ask about, you know, good resources and stuff like that. But, you know, well, it's easy enough to just list off like a couple books or something. I think coaching philosophy and mentors and influences is probably the bigger topic that I want to talk. You know, so we'll talk about, you know, sort of how you and I have each arrived you know, with the ideas that we have now. And for me, certainly, that began as an athlete. I think probably for basically any coach,
yeah,
unless they were formally, you know, trained just as a coach,
yeah,
through some, you know,
some weird
Soviet or Chinese. Well, because even the Chinese weightlifting coaches, they have to have been like a national level.
I think a national champion.
Yeah.
I think you have to be a real...
And so you're basically a world champion.
Yeah. Then. Yeah. And even in like Russia, I've heard like Vladimir Safonov, when he came here, he said there's no like top coaches that weren't at least like national team members.
Yeah. So, and then I've heard that interview with Zatsarowski where he talks about their coaching education system, and it's like a 4-year degree. But short of going through a 4-year coaching degree, most people's coaching journey and ideas about coaching probably comes from what they did themselves as athletes, and that was certainly the case for me as I began like forming these ideas of what is effective, and it was a lot of trial and error. And I've with the minor exceptions, stuff I'll talk about as we go, but have pretty much written my own program since I was 14 years old. And
is there a big difference between the 14-year-old Chad Wesley Smith program and the 28-year-old Chad Wesley Smith program?
For a 14-year-old, I wasn't doing too bad.
I remember you telling me one time that maybe you were younger than 14. Maybe this is before the formal programming. You had like tied some rubber bands to a tree.
Yeah, I guess if we were to go even farther back, this whole process began with seeing Rocky IV for the first time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Where most good coaches.
Yeah. Rocky IV training montage. Cool runnings training montages.
Fantastic, yeah. Chariots of Fire maybe thrown in there.
Yeah, all the classics. But yeah, that was that I was getting ready to play Pop Warner Junior All-American football for the first year, and I knew that it was like a tryout kind of thing. Like, not everyone made the team, I guess, which now thinking back on it, for 8, 9, 10-year-olds seems very unlikely. But at least in my mind, I was like, I got to make the team. Little Giants training montage probably came into play big with that one.
Possibly heavyweights. For me, for sure. Yeah.
So I was taking the car, bungee cords that you would tie stuff down in the back of a truck with.
Yeah.
And lashing those together, putting them around my waist, and like running against band resisted sprints in my backyard. I think it was 9. I was 8 or 9.
Damn.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
Yeah. So that's where it really began. But yeah, more so at 14 is when I started lifting weights and trying to learn about lifting weights on the internet in the year 2000.
Oh, man.
Nearly 20 years ago.
That's so crazy to think.
It was a much, much different place. Elite FTS existed, but way, way smaller. DeepSquatter.com.
Yeah. Dr. Squat had his forum too.
Yeah, the Dr. Squat, that was a big one. There was some Australian Olympic lifting page.
Yeah, Queensland Weightlifting Association.
Exactly, yeah. Queensland Weightlifting Association. I did the Critical Bench program.
Yeah.
But the big thing for me back then was I had an understanding, and it probably worked well because everyone likes to do what they're good at,
and
especially when you're 14, 15, 16 years old, that's probably even more true. I was good at squats and cleans and jumps and sprints, and I don't know if it was confirmation bias that brought me to this, but it was also I understood that's what's important for being good at football and throwing the shot put. So the first coach in that process who was very influential to me was Tony Chiarelli. So Tony Chiarelli is a football weightlifting throws coach, was then at Huntington Beach High School. But most of his career at Newport Harbor High School in Newport Beach, California, incredible results, for high school throwers.
Yeah.
He has a kid who just signed, to UCLA who threw like 64 and 198 as a junior in high school.
Damn.
I mean, if his top 10 list of throwers he's coached, I think it takes 59 or 60 feet to make it in the shot put.
Wow.
And like 188 or 190 feet in the discus.
Good Lord.
He had, I think, two of the top three, maybe three of the top five discus throwers ever in high school in California. also, was like a level 4 or 5 weightlifting coach, as is his wife. His daughter, he has one daughter who's the throws coach at UCI. His other daughter
was a resident at the Olympic Training Center, was on a Pan Am team or two for weightlifting.
Right.
And he had this clinic that I would go to, I think pretty much every year. It was a one day clinic, the World Class Throws Clinic, and it was, you know, a month or so before the track season started, and it was remarkable, you know, the coaches we got exposed to there and the athletes we got exposed to, because he had, you know, multiple Olympians, you know, guys who were trying to get on the Olympic team at the time, Jared Rome, Ian Waltz, people who had been and would go on to be Olympians, like Jason Tunks, Carl Brown, Mack Wilkins, Bill Starr, was there one of the years. I think he was there when I went as a coach. And he really, you know, hammered home that idea, because he was a weightlifting coach.
Yeah.
And, you know, trains his throwers very much with weightlifting, and very much like weightlifters often, but hammered home this idea that throwing and being an athlete is about, you know, jumping high and generating power from the lower body and throwing medicine balls and all that kind of stuff. And that stuck with me and was like the first true understanding that I had of, like, this is where power and how powerful athletes are created. And Tony was a huge influence, and it's been cool, you know, now 20 years, you know, almost 20 years later, to I live down the street and we're friends and talk about training and stuff. So for you first getting into weightlifting, what was that sort of spark?
You know, it was a lot of the same kind of thing, like, you know, being young and I mean, I watched, when I first got into it, I had seen the 96 Olympics and saw Naeem Suleimanoglu win his third gold, and was, you know, that was like this iconic moment for me. And I remember, you know, wanting to always be strong and wanting to kind of pursue that. But when I saw the Olympics, I was like, that's, I'm a weightlifter, right? I'm going to be a weightlifter. So it started with a lot of the same kind of stuff, where you just kind of are figuring things out on your own and doing stuff on your own. But eventually I got connected with the strength coach at Montana State, who I, funny enough, was like roommates with Chris Bell in UCLA or USC. And I think even Spitz, Dave Spitz, from, like, all three of them knew each other, right? But so, you know, I got connected with him, and then he introduced me to, you know, Steve Goff, who basically was like the first kind of, that was my first introduction to, like, formal coaching, as formal as that was. But it was much more of like a trial by fire kind of thing, where, you know, you'd look online, you'd find stuff, you'd find programs and things, and you had a coach at the same time who's telling you something. So it was much more of like a, there was not the pedigree that, you know, Cirelli had, where, like, oh, this guy's like produced a bunch of people consistently. It was more like, let's kind of figure this out as we go. And that's, you know, I think from an influential standpoint, it's like, wow, you learned a lot of shit that doesn't work. maybe you learn that early on, but your execution of, like, stopping the shitty things that aren't working takes a long time. But yeah, I mean, it was initially just basically like calling up USAW, like looking on their website, finding the coach in town. There happened to be a guy who was, you know, working for the university. He happened to live on the same street as me. And I just called him up and walked up there and was like, I want to be a weightlifter. And, you know, kind of went from there.
And then he's like, this is a max squat.
Yeah, here's a squat. You can just do these as many times as you want forever. So
The other thing, you know, that was great about Tony for me in this process was, because I went to a school known for its academics, not its athletics.
Yeah.
That when I would be at these track meets, I was like the only good person on my high school track
team. Huge standout amongst the other youths from Irvine.
Yeah. So I was, you know, they were all at SAT prep classes, and I was lifting weights, you know, getting the easy way to make it to Berkeley. Not like where you have to get a 4.5 GPA. But I would be at these track meets, the bigger meets, Orange County Championships, stuff like that, on my own. And my coach, who is Coach Len Blutrick, phenomenal coach, coached me my junior and senior in high school. His son, Brian, is now the throws coach at Arizona State, was a 92 Olympian in the discus, national throws coach of the year, I bet, 4 or 5 times now between his 10 years at ASU, University of Oklahoma, University of North Carolina. You know, Coach Blue was great and hugely influential in my career, but I would almost call him more of a technical consultant.
Nah.
he coached my throwing, but even in high school, I did my own lifting and everything. And Coach Blue was a college coach, so he wasn't at my high school meets with me. You know, very, very rarely, like state meet, maybe one other.
Yeah.
So I was typically at these meets by myself, and I was so interested in lifting and training and how to improve, and knew that you know, talking to coaches and was like the best way to figure out how to do this, that I just latched on to Chiarelli. You know, was buddies with one of the guys that he was coaching, and then also a coach named Bill Pendleton at Esperanza in Orange County, who's
he'll
probably have, I think, his what's going to be his second 70-foot shot putter.
Damn.
Guy just committed to Cal.
He's got a ton of kids there.
Yeah,
and see when they came to Juggernaut back then, it was crazy.
That, kid, the one like stocky little blonde kid who was, I think, a freshman then.
Yeah.
He's a senior now, threw like 67 feet last year, just committed to Cal. Bench was like 430.
Yeah. Wow. That's awesome. Holy cow.
Yeah. And so I really just like latched on to those guys and would keep asking them questions at the meet.
Yeah.
Like probably until they were sick of talking to me, maybe past that point. And as I got into college and started to read more about training, you know, I guess if that was, well, maybe the Rocky montages, that's stage, that was phase one of learning how to coach or developing my philosophy. High school was phase two. And early in college, I'd say that's kind of the next distinct part for me was I came to Cal on a track scholarship and you know, our coach had us doing what she had us doing, and I wasn't getting much stronger. And then I think it was my maybe summer between my freshman and sophomore year, I'd started reading a lot more, learning about this thing called conjugate periodization.
Finally, he's admitting it.
Yes, the conjugate periodization was getting really into reading. I at that time and for several years after, when West Side apologists, defenders, whatever, want to say like, oh, Chad doesn't even know what he's talking about. I've read up to that point had read every single article on their website, every single article on West Side, every single article on Elite FTS, printed them out, printed them off my computer. Highlighting things, keeping notes on them. Side note to that, I understand if you're listening to this and you're like, well, Chad doesn't really understand it. You're wrong. I understand everything about training better than you do. Like, if you're someone who's sitting there thinking, no, he's wrong, West Side does work, it's even more true that I understand everything about training more than you do.
Well, I mean, shit, you were using combinating resistance at 6 years old.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. But I'd read all that stuff, and I was so fucking into it.
Yeah.
And I remember going back to my coaches at Cal, being like, hey, can I do some of this stuff? And they were very apprehensive about it. And I remember talking to Tony about it, and Tony, I got to ask him this story. I got to record him telling me this story, because I know he was there. And I know that you probably know guys that were there. It was like an NSCA conference in late 90s. And there was like the USAW group. And then there was like Louie.
Oh, I've heard of this. Yeah.
And Louie was basically, made his presentation and like saying how the weightlifters, saying what Louie says. Yeah. American weightlifting coaches don't know how to get people strong.
Blah, blah, blah.
And they need to do, stiff leg fat bar snatches and stuff. Stuff like trap bar snatches, probably.
The old trap bar snatch.
Yeah. And there was like this incredible tension in this conference room. I think Tony was there. I'm sure.
Yeah.
I think it was like Tony and Mike Bergner and those kind of guys were there. I got to ask him about it. But I remember like asking Tony about this stuff and like, man, this is a coach that I really respect and look up to. and him calling them like those West Side guys or those powerlifting guys, and like really like scoffing at the at the idea that I'd brought up, and that was such like the I was like, oh my God, like I don't know how to react right now. Like my parents are fighting. I don't know which one do I side with. and it being like, and I decided to go with the West Side.
It's like a moment where you finally, like, all of the Bill Cosby stuff comes out, and you're like, but I really love Mr. Huxtable.
My childhood has been a lie.
You can't decide.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that was, like, I was the same kind of stuff, like, with the this is a little different, because you had a lot of exposure to actual coaches and people that had different opinions and, you know, Cirelli's camp and stuff, where I was completely isolated, and I had one coach who had, you know, who was, you know, probably clinically insane, and had one methodology. But I was exposed to a lot of the same writing and stuff online, so I had that sort of foundation under me. But I didn't have the actual, like, being able to talk to a real coach who could tell you there's something different about somebody saying, like, "Hey, here's the program, here's what's written," and then a coach explaining what they do. It's so different, because the program can seem, every little variable can seem so significant and important. And when you don't understand any, like, of you know, principles or anything bigger than just sets and reps, you know, you're looking at something and it's like dramatic. It's really like, oh my God, like, how important is it to do 70% for three sets instead of four sets? And so, you know, you're always in this, like, being isolated like that, I was always into this problem of, like, the details of things. How important is detail? So you see something like Westside, and it's all about details. It's all about these, like, ridiculous, like, charts and numbers. It seems so overwhelming that, like, this must be real. This must be really true, because there's no way anyone would write a fucking book or, you know, write an article. I mean, he's got 800, you know, 700-pound deadlifters. And it'd just be like numbers and lists. And the stuff seems so complex
overwhelming.
Right.
And it's what appears to be its complexity. And
yeah. And you're kind of trapped by that. And so, like, I remember it really was like, for me, it was like, I always believed, you know, early on, I was like, believed that, like, West Side must be better because it's all about science and numbers and accommodating resistance and circumax phases. Yeah. And, you know, obviously as time goes on, you get exposed to other coaches who can explain things and be like, yeah, well, this is like what's really going on.
Yeah. And it's, you know, as many jokes as we make about West Side, I did very well for myself, you know, using those ideas, you know, for my own training as I threw the shot put, and for when I started coaching, and I began, you know, as a professional coach in the sense that I was being paid to coach athletes, the summer after my freshman year of college, I came back and, like, ran our summer lifting conditioning program for our high school football team, and then did the same thing. And then the next summer after that, I came back. I had transferred away from Cal at that point and came back to be defensive line coach and run, you know, all the summer conditioning, off-season stuff. And it was, you know, so many of those West Side articles and Elite FTS articles, you know, that specific ones don't stand out in my mind, but DeFranco, West Side for Scrum Bastards. And then there was an article on Elite FTS by Joe Ken, called Max Effort Training for the Front Seven.
Yeah.
And that was the first time that I'd seen, like, something that seemed very systematic in its individualization towards different position groups. And even back then, you know, this was 2000 and summer of 2006 that I started, you know, again, professionally coaching. I was 19, or just turned 20. And that was like I was able to kind of take that article and extrapolate it, you know, out from what he had for the offensive and defensive linemen, for, you know, linebacker, tight end types, and then wide receivers, defensive backs, and that was like a big moment.
Yeah,
I think for me of understanding, like, all right, this is how these principles,
yeah,
You know, even though they're it's not stuff that I would do now necessarily, it was still important. That's how these principles can be changed for different
needs. I think that's like the biggest thing that Westside really did, and from a positive impact it had, and the fact that it appeared that prior to what Westside and what Louis and those guys kind of pushed, it was about like a program. Like, here's the 5x5 program. Mm-hmm. And the program was just this static thing that existed that was, you know, just do this. You're a football player. This is what you do. Maybe there'd be some programs written for like different positions on a football team or like different sports, but it's basically just like, here's the hard and fast, you know, recipe for what you do. Whereas Westside kind of introduced the concept of a system via, you know, the Russian Soviet weightlifting system, which was like, hey, like there's solutions for everything that exist within this because it's a system. It's, you know, plug and play different pieces to get the recipe for this position or for that sport or whatever. Whereas that just didn't exist before. So I think that was, like you're saying, like a huge leap forward in thinking. Was the application of it really excellent, or the execution probably not the best, but the fact that it was a system was a huge leap forward.
That is, you know, a big point of credit I think to give to Louis and to Westside.
We can edit this all out later.
in my coaching development for sure is a, you know, assessing what an athlete needs, and you know they talk about it mostly from, you know, figuring out what your weak point is in the squat, bench, and deadlift, but that idea can be, you know, extrapolated out to the needs analysis for an athlete in a multimodal sport where they have to have speed and strength and endurance and everything, and where are they lacking, and how does that all fit together? You know, again, the application they use for it is not what I choose to do, obviously, now, but and then for me working with athletes and, you know, still throwing the shot put and stuff at that point in my own career, the other big takeaway from it was move heavy shit fast.
Yeah.
And that that holds true to still be very useful for team sport athletes like football players and shot putters, is move heavy shit fast and always putting an emphasis on the intent.
Yeah,
I think it was really, really important.
Yeah, I think the kind of next, like the next step from there was a much longer step though. Like going from the idea of like programs are these things that are static and like, you know, 5x5 is the best program, to there's systems that are in place that are, you know, okay, like you have to create a system that has answers for different problems. To where I think like the next logical move from there for me was really like Mike Isertel and you and kind of seeing that, okay, shit, like the concept of principles are way bigger and way more foundational than systems themselves, because systems and programs are built on principles. And then, you know, seeing that move was not as quick a change from, oh, okay, like there's programs. Oh, Westside has like a system. It was years of like seeing people kind of floundering around with, you know, probably between like 2000 and really like 2000. I don't know when Mike wrote, you guys wrote Principles.
2014.
So you got like, I would say a good 15 years, 14 years in there where like Westside was dominating, bouncing around this idea. It almost stifled the progress, I think, because people looked at Westside as like, okay, what are the solutions within Westside for athletes? Mm. So it became like, well, you know, you do more speed work for football players, or you do something like, you know, whatever, this silly kind of like really weird special exercises that have no, you know, no bearing on sport form for a team sport. And like people are constantly looking for the answer they weren't finding because they're looking in the wrong place, until you see principles, you know, until you kind of step back to that foundational stuff, you don't actually have the answers to the problem. So as a coach, moving from like programs to systems to principles was like this big shift for me, at least later on.
Well, and so for me, I went through doing a lot of different programs.
Yeah.
Whether it was, you know, these amalgams of Queensland weightlifting plus critical bench times jump soles, which I did, and that was those were some hell long days right there. To West Side stuff, to the programs they had us doing it at Cal. This whole time, you were just doing the same thing.
Yeah,
the same thing. And I think it's very rare that a coach who has such a long history of doing one thing, and even if it's one discipline, like if you have a strength coach, a strength and conditioning coach who spent their entire career competing in weightlifting, they are very, very likely to use a lot of weightlifting in training their athletes.
Yeah.
Same thing holds true with powerlifting. If in the unfortunate case that someone does kettlebell sport, they're probably really big on using kettlebells. But not only was your entire, so much of your athletic career spent doing weightlifting, it was spent doing one extremely narrow vein of
weightlifting. Oh my God,
If you guys haven't heard about Roan, you're really missing out. Roan is a men's performance lifestyle and premium activewear brand that is engineered for unparalleled quality and comfort. They're an absolute necessity for guys on the go. It doesn't matter if you're training in the gym, getting on a flight. They are your new go-to men's clothing brand. My favorite are the Peak polos, which I can wear out to dinner. I can wear on the golf course. On the occasion that I have a fancy, juggernaut meeting, I need to get out of gym clothes, I'll put it on for that as well. I also really like the Sentry tanks to train in, the Mako shorts, Guru shorts, got a ton of different stuff from Roan. Their variety is really what's best. They make something for the modern man regardless of occasion. So from shorts, shirts, tank tops, socks, swimwear, Roan engineers clothing perfect for the office, long flights, and commutes. And now they just released their amazing new commuter collection. So if they're perfect for looking great, staying comfortable at the office. You're riding the subway to work, you got a lunch meeting, whatever it is, Commuter Collection has got you covered with style and versatility. It is the performance alternative to everyday workwear, offering everything from pants, polos, shorts, and shirts. They're all lightweight, comfortable, and wrinkle-free. The Commuter Collection is good for all weather, anytime from a weekday in the workplace or to a weekend barbecue. So go to roan.com/juglife today and use the promo code JUGLIFE to get 20% off your first purchase. That's rhone.com/juglife, promo code JUGLIFE for 20% off. Roan.com/juglife, promo code JUGLIFE.
So there had to be, was there ever a time when you started coaching lifters that you coached them in the same way in the bulk
of the
system?
You know, probably like the very first few people I worked with, I was like, well, we'll do some variation of what we're doing. To out myself for being wrong in these things, when I was doing all of that training, I was very well read in all of these other things. Like, I knew everything that from Elite, I read every article every Friday, like T Nation, Testosterone Net.
T Nation used to have good articles.
Yeah, and I was I read
Charlie Francis articles and shit.
And Charlie Francis. And then, I was
saying that, by the way, I mean that they don't have good articles. Yeah. Now, if you didn't get the insinuation.
And, Verka Shansky, when he was still alive, he had his forum, he had his whole thing. Like, I read through everything. I always was super into that. And I read all the Russian translations and everything, but I was still doing that stuff because I had a coach that was coaching me. And so I just did what we were supposed to do. Because obviously buying in and believing in what you're doing is super important. So there came a point, though, where, like, I knew what we were doing wasn't right. I knew it wasn't working.
And to quickly clarify for people, Steve Goff is nicknamed the American Butcher after Max's other coach of more note, Ivan Abajayev, the Butcher. So
the original Butcher.
Yeah. So from the start of your weightlifting career with any formal coaching, you were doing the Bulgarian system.
To the extreme.
Steve Goff or under Abajev.
So I knew, like, I was very well aware of what was existing outside of what I was doing and could grasp, like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. Like, there's this process, there's a system to it. You know, there's a solution if you have this problem. There's like things you should do that are different. But you know, obviously, like the execution, which I think is the biggest component of being a good coach, I didn't do. I didn't change my program. I didn't do those things. But going through that and knowing all of those things, you know, when I first started coaching people, I initially was like, well, I'll coach what I believe is right because I've bought into it, you know, because I'm in this. That's what we're doing is coaching Bulgarian stuff. It was always going to be less than what I did. It was never going to have me squat 10 times in a day or 5 times in a day or snatch to maximum every day. But it was very much in this vein of like the same logic. Well, if you want to get good at snatching, then just snatch. Or you want to get good at clean and jerks, then just clean and jerk. Or, you know, these kind of like, and like what you call like a isms, but like, you know, it's just like this really simple cereal box kind of answer to something like, oh, you know, if you know, your clean tricks are bad, you got to train heavier. Or like, you can't PR unless you're going heavy all the time. When you step back and think about it, you're like, those are fucking retarded. Like, I can't believe I was that dumb. But you also realize like, okay, you're kind of just stuck in this place where you have a few tools because you only know these things. So it's difficult to just jump in and apply something you don't understand or don't have experience with. So yeah, I mean, the first people I coached were, sorry, but you guys got fucked over.
I mean, did you switch it up at all? Like,
yeah, so
like
then,
doing jerks from the rack instead of from blocks? Or
a remarkable amount of individualizing your own program by switching the exercise. I did. Yeah, there was a point where, and probably like the same point with every coaching evolution I've had, where it came from a moment of like, okay, you're coaching somebody and the greatest teacher you're ever going to have is failure, because like, shit, this person just didn't do well and they're not getting better. And it's obvious when you become a professional coach, people pay you for that service and they stop paying you for that service because you're doing a bad job. You very quickly realize that you need to get better. So, you know, I can't remember every single moment, but I do remember distinct times where people would perform better when I did something different that was maybe drawn from different, you know, from a book or something. Oh, you know, look at the Russian system or look at how other coaches are doing things and say, I'm going to try something that's in that vein and move things towards that direction. And you see progress, you see an improvement. You know, that was like, those were the moments that just kind of kept happening where it'd be like, hey, I'm going to do it differently than this. I'm going to do it differently than this. I'm going to change this. We're not going to squat as much or this and that. And you have a little evolution where you're like, okay, this is a better way to do that. This is a better way to approach it. And you just kind of have these over and over. I think at some point you get to a point though, where you and I did as a coach too early on, like you can think that like, oh, it's about always finding the next thing that's right. And you know, every coach has these little epiphanies and these changes to what they do until they get, you know, they start getting closer to the bullseye. But then when you're close to the bullseye, it stops becoming about finding the next best thing. It becomes about executing the system better and finding, hey, we know this is right. How do I apply it in a way that makes it as effective as possible? So you're not looking for something new. You're looking for
micro changes, not macro
right,
changes.
Yeah. And the adjustments to like, if adherence to the program is better, the program works better. Or if the program is, you know, just done in a way where, you know, we're monitoring technique better or we're doing these little things better. Yeah. You get the same kind of effect. So it was definitely like, knowing I was wrong initially and then slowly breaking away from that in practice.
Yeah, I think the next big phase of development for me, so I really start to discover West Side, Conjugate, all that stuff. Mind you, I'm reading all these things that are articles about multiply powerlifting training, and I did not understand that multiply power, like what that was, what that meant. I just read the article and it said this guy squatted 1,100 pounds. Well, I was 19 and could squat, you know, 650-ish pounds. So that wasn't like that far-fetched of an idea to me. I figured, okay, I'm a sophomore now. By the time I'm a redshirt senior, I'll probably squat like 800 or 850 or something. And so some other guy doing 1100, that wasn't, that,
probably graduate college with a 1250 squat, yeah, I guess.
Like these ideas were not that outlandish to me.
Yeah.
Especially when, being in the throwing world, I'm seeing stuff about Udo Beyer and Greg Trefalis.
Yeah.
And thinking like, okay, well, these guys are doing 950 or 400 kilos for five.
Udo Beyer. He's just some guy in Germany, I think. He was pretty strong. Yeah. They can get there.
So that's like summer of 2005 where I start learning about that stuff. And 2005, 6, 7, 8, I'm coaching high school football. I'm training for the shot put myself. And I am balls deep into Westside. If you told me in 2008 that Westside doesn't work, I was ready to fight you.
How many fire beanies did you own?
Thankfully none, but I definitely had a different,
a yellow Westside shirt, a fire beanie.
No, but you can find pictures of me my senior year of college at track meets with the black Westside shirt.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And just listened to a lot angrier music.
Yeah.
And it was just a different man. And I've said this before, but like 23-year-old Chad Wesley Smith, he would fucking hate 33-year-old Chad Wesley Smith. And that's not, I think some people, could say that about themselves because they turned into sellouts or whatever. That this is only true because 23-year-old Chad Wesley Smith was clearly a buffoon. Yeah. But no, so I was so fucking into it. Like, legit would be ready, like, would want to fight someone if they were telling me that it didn't work. And just as we were talking about this, it brought up this memory of a time where I was so pissed about someone telling me that the way I was training was wrong.
And wow.
It was in very early Juggernaut days. I was friends with Bob Eilenfeld, the angry coach. And I was still, training, throwing the shot put. I had just opened Juggernaut, so I had just finished my senior year of college. This great year, I threw, 10 feet farther than I had thrown the year before.
Yeah.
And it was awesome. And Bob Eilenfeld was friends with one of our mutual friends, James Smith.
Yeah.
And Bob, he wrote under the pen name The Angry Coach, and he was very much that. He was this, Long Island, or like Staten Island, Long Island,
just
fucking gruff New Yorker, tell it like it is. And we're talking one day, and he's like, oh yeah, he's like, I was talking to James Smith, and like, he says you're training like a fucking idiot. And I was like, what the fuck did he say about my training? This fucking thinker, nerd, jackass. And
how many thousands of pounds of barbell volume I do every day before I warm up?
Yeah, I was so fucking pissed. And I remember him telling me that and just like seething about it. And then like Bob convincing me to like talk to James on the phone, or that James wanted to talk to me, and maybe Bob delivered James's message a bit more gruffly than James had, but
it's definitely not the way James would have said it.
not in like a presentation, but to Bob, I could have seen him saying it like that. Yeah, now that I know James, but anyways, James was doing that not to be like, oh, this Chad Smith guy is a fucking jackass. He was doing it because he genuinely wanted to help.
Yeah.
Maybe he didn't bring it up quite the right way.
Yeah.
To get his message across. But anyways, I talked to him on the phone, and he begins explaining to me this idea of special strength and Dr. Bondarchuk, and this was probably late 2009, very early 2010. And I heard him. Yeah, I probably did go into the conversation with a bit of a closed mind because I was like, this guy's, what the fuck shot putter has he ever coached? So how much weight has he lifted? I'm stronger. I do this better. And didn't want to listen to him, but did do my best to hear him out. And at the end of the conversation, a lot of what he said resonated with me in that I understood what its value could be, but I did not understand it well enough to apply it for myself.
Yeah. Yeah,
I remember feeling caught it kind of between these two situations of he was telling me to step back from the really heavy lifting that I was doing and the really hard, you know, max effort work. And in my mind, basically, he was telling me to stop being so strong.
Yeah.
And do more of these kind of weird, you know, harder to measure exercises and to throw more. And I got that concept, but I didn't know how to apply it for myself.
Yeah.
So I felt like, well, if I don't do that stuff, if I don't do the special strength stuff right, and now I'm not lifting as hard, now I'm just not as strong, nor do I have this, you know, not as generally strong, nor do I have the special strength to balance it out, and then I'm fucked. So I didn't, and you know, in hindsight, I probably should have just asked James, like, well, can you write this for me, or but that was the first kind of time where I heard something, I heard it be explained, and I was like, he has a point.
Yeah, yeah.
And I couldn't quite commit to it, so I kept doing what I was doing, and then I finished my throwing career in May 2010, and well, I guess let's. Around that same time that Bob had delivered this message to me from James, I had the opportunity, because I was sponsored by Elite FTS at this time, I had the opportunity where I was supposed to go out to Ohio for an Elite FTS event, and I was going to go to Westside on Friday and Elite on Saturday.
Yeah.
And this is in the time where James Smith says this guy is training like an asshole, and I'm like, where the fuck does he live? Send location because fuck this guy. I'm going to fight him because he said that Westside doesn't work. So I'm ready to go on a religious pilgrimage for me out there.
And a duffel bag full of chains and bands and fire beanies.
And the trip was really a trip for me to go to Elite FTS. And that for some reason got canceled. So I didn't end up going. And I wasn't going to go, or I couldn't probably afford to go to just see Westside or whatever, or make the trip on my own without it being like an official Elite FTS thing or whatever. So I ended up not going. And in, you know, some sort of butterfly effect, alternate dimensions, we're rolling the dice of, you know, and each number has a different possible universe that we're living in. There is a universe in which I go to this trip.
Yeah.
And I wonder, had I done that, if I would have been so far down the rabbit hole of...
You would have crossed the event horizon. There's no way out of it. There would have been no way back.
That's somewhere, you know, at about 6:30 a.m. at a Bob Evans in Columbus, Ohio, I would have passed a point of no return.
Yeah.
And from there to the end of history, I would have forever been ready to fight someone who said that Westside doesn't work.
You would, if you had gone, you would have been on ESPN3 in the WPO a couple weeks ago. God, you'd have been up there.
I would probably fucking slaughter those guys.
But you would be training like them. So it'd be equal. Yes. You'd be squatting 12 and a half inches high.
I'd actually have to jump.
You only go up in the squat somehow.
But yeah, so I wonder, you know, what that universe, that's a scary place. It's a scary world to live in. And so again, you know, then fast forward back to like May or June 2010, I had still been doing Westside. I meanwhile had written the Juggernaut Method and had gotten away from using Westside as much with athletes at the gym, though I was still using it some. And even I'm not opposed to using it now, particularly in like a short time frame situation with like a speed power team sport athlete. But I remember I did my last track meet, and then I was like, all right, I'm going to do a powerlifting meet. I've only done box squats for the last 3 years. I had not done a free squat, I don't think.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And yeah, probably three going on 4 years.
When you box squatted, did you use like a real wide stance and sit way back, or did you squat more like a normal?
I mean, wider.
Yeah.
Not like, I wasn't trying to like put my feet under the outside of the power rack or anything, but I was definitely trying to, you know, sit back, open my knees more. Like,
did you feel, because you and I are built pretty similar, like at least our like lower bodies, where like I always felt like trying to squat like that made me feel so weak, like squatting more wide and sitting back a lot more, where it's just, I mean, I, you know, my experience with Westside was much shorter than yours, but like I always remember feeling like this is really unnatural feeling, like it didn't feel strong at all. And I'm just curious, because like I wonder how much that just like, you know, plays into those kind of things for somebody.
You know? It's I don't have a specific memory of that. I think I had box squatted 725. Mm-hmm. And I was squatting to like a legitimate box height, and you can go back in old Juggernaut YouTube videos and find, you know, videos of me doing cambered bar box squats with chains and safety squat bar box with bands and all this kind of stuff. And so it was like a legit box height. And so I'd done 725, and then I was like, all right, I gotta see what I can squat, because there's no box at the meet.
It's probably like 950.
Yeah, I'm glad that I had that amount of sense to not just show up to the meet and be like, all right, well.
How much weight did you get stapled with?
You know, I remember squatting, I want to say, I think I squatted 550 for either 3 or 5 reps.
After a 7.25 box squat.
Yeah, so it's okay.
Yeah, not bad.
Not that far off.
Yeah.
But I also remember feeling like, this is a lot different. And the bottom part was really hard. Like, and it at that was like the next moment where I was like, I can't.
Yeah.
Do this. This is not what's going to make me good at powerlifting. And so I did the Juggernaut method, you know, exactly as written in the first book for that meet, and squatted 800. And I know that the heaviest squat I did in training in sleeves, or not even in sleeves, it's bare knees. It was 635 for 5. So I'd gone from either 545 for 3 to 5 reps to 635 for 5 in 4 months.
Oh,
and
really
then,
good.
Then put knee wraps on and did 765 in training and then 800 at the meet.
Yeah.
And about a month after that was the first time I actually did go to Elite FTS. So it was like 1 year after the original trip was supposed to happen. And I'm out there and I'm sponsored by them. And that was the first time I had been around multiply lifting.
Yeah.
It was when I went to my first meet to compete. It was also the first meet I'd been to. And you know, I just didn't know what to expect. I still did not know what powerlifting equipment was, really.
Wow.
I knew that while we were getting rack heights at that meet, there was a guy who asked me what I was opening at, and I said 725, and he said, me too, like kind of scoffed, and he's like, ah, me too, in the bench.
Oh, well.
And he then bombed out. So that wasn't a great first impression for equipped lifting on me. Was
I can guess what his three bench attempts were, too. The first one was took 7 seconds to get to 3 inches above his chest, and then they took it. The second one, they put more weight on, got it to his chest, and then couldn't move it. And the third one, he almost killed himself. Standard 3 bench attempts and multiply.
So, and then that time at Elite, I'm doing my thing, lifting, you know, raw, or wearing my knee wraps, and I squatted 635 for 10 or 11 there in knee wraps. And my whole workout took like an hour and a half, and then there's like 2 monolifts with, you know, 7 guys on each one, and they did like 11 reps of squats total in like 3.5 hours. And I was just like, this is weird. Like,
And it
was from there. Yeah, and then the next year, James, you know, the same James Smith who once said that Chad Smith guy doesn't know what the fuck he's doing, or you know, he's training like an asshole or whatever, comes to work for me. And that's, you know, if there's 1 year, one situation I had to pick out that like this formed, or this was the biggest catalyst towards the way that I coach and understand training now, it's that year with James. And so much of the stuff that people always point to, you know, and they tell you, oh, read Super Training, read Science and Practice and Strength Training, you know, read Charlie Francis, read Yesus, Isser, and all this stuff. People tell you to read that shit, and they don't know what the fuck the words on that page mean. They are barely English.
Yeah.
James Smith knows yeah. what they meant, and I saw him put them into practice, and it was so simple and intuitive,
yeah,
and it was like beyond like a light bulb, you know. It was the whole fucking like,
yeah, the whole
like
thing,
lamp
yeah.
and light store turned on instantaneously, and I was like, this is it just totally changed my perspective on it. He made me understand why max effort, dynamic effort, West Side type of stuff for athletes isn't the best thing. Not that it's a bad thing, yeah. It's just not quite the best. You know, giving me the understanding of the Charlie Francis Cup analogy, and you can only fill it up so much, and weight room is general for athletes, yeah, yeah. and all that. And so that was the big piece. So it was that sort of transition time, you know, with maybe the initial catalyst being James saying, I didn't know what the fuck I was doing, to then starting to train for powerlifting, that really created the shift to then, you know, go on and do the work with Mike and with you and understand about individualization and all this
yeah.
kind of stuff.
Yeah. I think it's kind of funny because when you think about both of our journeys, it sort of strikes me as like there's these, you know, these phases we're talking about of like coaching and it like the kernel that exists from the beginning was that as athletes, we were definitely both way really interested in how it worked and in the idea of like, how does the program work and the training and that. And then that kind of like spark, I think, seems to transfer into like, well, you're going to kind of pursue it. And if you have this inclination to figure it out, you're always going to be looking for some kind of better answer or some kind of better thing. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, without that as a coach, like it's got to be difficult to go anywhere. If you are just looking for the right answer or looking for an answer, you're going to get stuck because the first flashy thing like Westside that comes along is going to be like, well, this is the way to do it, you know?
Yeah, and I see, you know, specific to Westside, and it's not to pick on Westside that much, but I see now, you know, younger coaches or lifters, you know, they come in and they're 22, 23 years old, and they're just starting to figure this stuff out. And I have less patience for it now in 2019 because there is so much more
yeah.
body of evidence of like, let's look at what the 100 best lifters in the world do, the 1,000 best right. lifters in the world do. But yeah, to back this up maybe 4 or 5 years, then I was seeing people who like, they were really into Westside. And this is also a time, you know, 2013, 2014, we were writing, you know, JTS was putting out articles like West Side versus the World, like Why Speed yeah. Work Doesn't Work, you know, like an incredible editorial piece that I wrote, still the best title I've ever created, The Bench Shirt Is Being Pulled Over Your Eyes, where we were writing these, you know, controversial articles or whatever, and getting into, you know, I had to like allot a good bit of time per day to just argue with people on the internet yeah. about how to lift. And then when I actually, you know, really, really cared about this type of thing, I would see these, you know, 22, 23 year old people try and argue with me. And it's like, you know, and the age, I guess, is irrelevant because I was like 27 and 28, but I was strong and good at powerlifting and they weren't. So, you know, and for a while I'd get mad and be like, who the fuck is this, you know, little dumbass trying to argue yeah. with me? And then I was like, you know, I was that dumbass.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to give them 2 years. And in 2 years, they will have figured it out. They will have changed their ways.
Yeah.
Or they just don't get it.
Yeah.
And you know, it's that idea that you got to be progressing in the yeah. understanding, which is, again, not to pick specifically on my side type of stuff, but shocking, alarming, amazing to me to see some of these people who have been doing so much of the same stuff
yeah.
for 10 years, 20 years,
yeah.
30 years. And it's like,
it's incredible
in such an objective sport
yeah.
where you can so easily measure improvement when it doesn't exist to keep going, trying yeah. to keep doing the same thing.
We see the same with the Bulgarian stuff. I mean, the fact that there's people in either one of the sports, weightlifting or powerlifting, that still bring up the idea of the Bulgarian system, where it's like, it's just, and you know, this always kind of comes back to the idea of like principles in training. If you can't define, like, every single program that exists can be defined by the same parameters, like volume, intensity, the weights on the bar. Like, we can just look at any millions of programs and compare them to each other. But for some reason, there's this belief, and I think it's true with the West Side Fanatics, true with the Bulgarian Fanatics, where it's like there's a mysticism around it that, like, there's something more than what the data tells you. You know, the data tells you generally that your results are not getting better, you're not improving, but there's, like, some kind of mystery, and it's always like, you know, well, the Bulgarians were really great, or you know, West Side, they have this, or it's like there's something that's happening that's somehow intangible that can't be included in the data. But then they use you kind of fall into this trap of, like, using justification for it. And in weightlifting, you see all the time, like, blame the athlete, right? Oh man, we trained really hard. He hit this lift 18 times in training before this, but then he bombed the meet. And when you step back and look at it from the standpoint of, like, understanding the principles behind training, you can look and be like, well, it's really fucking obvious why he bombed out, because he destroyed himself 18 times before this, right?
The Bulgarian one, you know, and I see this in, like, YouTube comments on our videos on this topic,
yeah,
of, you know, critique of Bulgarian or Bulgarian, you know, Bulgarian system explained something, is when this fucking YouTube commenters, the scum of the earth, worst people in history, only if you post with your real name, it's fine.
Yeah.
If you post, you know, like,
there's a number of combinations that can create a name on YouTube.
Yeah, like Muscle Monkey 69. Like, I don't give a fuck about your opinion. Like, and they post on there, like, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. My squat has gone up,
yeah,
you know, 30 pounds in the last, yeah, 8 weeks.
I squat 275 with this.
Yeah. And it's like, for someone to argue Bulgarian with you, like, unless it is a Bulgarian person, where is their base of understanding? Like, it's like, did you watch the video when Max said that his squat went up 52 kilos in 6 weeks?
Yeah.
Did you stop watching it? Did you stop watching it then to not see what happened for the next 10 years?
Well, you explained everything I need to know in the first 12 seconds. I'm done.
Sounds great.
There's another 10 minutes here. Yeah, I don't know what that could be about. 52
kilos in 6 weeks.
It's funny. It's a very funny thing to be. But again, like, it's like when you're not rooted in that, like, that concept of understanding the process or understanding what happens, you know, you end up stuck in a place where you can only understand the answers. You can only understand, okay, this guy got better or didn't get better. It's the, you know, the program has to either work or it's some other reason. Like, the Bulgarian system works unless people fuck up, unless it's the athlete who's an idiot or they don't have enough courage. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so it's like, because that can't be wrong, everything in the universe is wrong. Gravity, there's something wrong with gravity. The program's not working.
Yeah. You know, my last thought about the stuff from James, who is hugely influential on me. Global Sport Concepts is his company, his website. Go read his stuff. You know, it's going to be, you're going to slog through it. It's tough, but worthwhile. Do the consultations with them. All that stuff is really good. And this is something I think that's held true for my entire, you know, career, athlete, coach, learning, is I was really able to see him take these sport training ideas, track and field specifically, and take the concepts, the principles from them, and apply them to strength sports.
Yeah.
And you know, for me, as he helped me with my own training, was apply those ideas to powerlifting and strongman. And even talking about, like, short to long and long to short, which is like a sprint training idea, and apply that to the moving events in strongman, and explain, all right, well, if you're, you know, if someone who's really strong but maybe needs to develop the endurance, they're going to do a short to long or vice versa. And to be able to extrapolate some of those ideas out was a really significant thing to me. And I think a great take home for people as they develop their coaching philosophies is don't be, you know, narrow-minded in that I'm only going to listen to this one coach, even if it's, you know, me and Max. Don't just listen to us. I mean, just mostly listen to us.
Yeah.
But, you know, and don't just... And that you're a powerlifting coach, so you're only going to listen to powerlifters and powerlifting coaches. Don't do that either.
Yeah.
You know, the more of my powerlifting coaching ideas have come from weightlifting and track and field than they have from powerlifting.
Yeah.
And weightlifting and track and field, those are Olympic sports in which governments, you know, spend hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars to develop athletes, educate their coaches, and win medals. That is a really big deal to China, Russia, you know, the former Soviet Union, yeah. East Germany. They were spending a shitload of time, money, and effort on learning how to do this stuff right. They weren't trying to learn how to coach powerlifting right, because that didn't win them Olympic medals and yeah. bring them nationalistic glory, you know, but they did spend a lot of effort on that. So seek that information out,
yeah.
understand it from a principle based, you know, from the principle based side of things, and extrapolate those ideas out to what you are interested in improving at. Powerlifting, strongman, you know, take those track and field ideas, apply them to weightlifting. Yeah, if you're working with athletes, whatever it is, that's going to be the best information that you can get, in my opinion.
Yeah, yeah. So I think the progression is like that. You know, it's going to be like every coach is probably going to start. The first thing you do when you start is you need some tool, right? You're going to grab onto something. So you grab onto programs or you know, something simple like that, or exercises, and then you grow from there as a coach, and you start to understand systems and like how to put a bunch of pieces together to get what you want. And then you eventually get to the point where you understand the principles behind things. And then you can go from there to, you know, building anything you want out of the principles. And even using those, once you understand those principles, you can look at every kind of sport training and draw conclusions from that and be able to transfer knowledge that's specific to whatever sport, you know, track and field, into something that's going to benefit you in weightlifting or powerlifting. So obviously, if you're going to start, if I was going to suggest to a person now to start, I would start the opposite way that you and I did, where I would start with understanding the principles and understanding the big picture stuff, and then go from there to start creating, you know, systems and workouts and coaching from there.
Yeah. Yeah. And understand the processes. It's never done.
Yeah.
The changes may become smaller. Like we said, you know, we made a lot of macro changes yeah. through this process, and now we're making the micro changes. But like, unless you're hitting, your athlete is hitting bullseye every yeah. meet they go out,
yeah.
like there's something to be improved at some part of the process. Cause not, like, we're only talking the program here.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
There's a whole other, you know, conscious coaching type of stuff of communicating with the athlete and psychology and all that good stuff. So
what do you think the next step is for someone like yourself or me, where do you see, like, okay, what's the next step that you would have made or that you'd make now? Obviously, you're not going to learn some giant new thing. There's obviously tons of new little pieces of data that usually just basically confirm what a lot of coaches have figured out. But do you think there's another like level or whatever that you would end up at?
Yeah, I think the sort of next piece to do a better job with is probably monitoring fatigue and being able to quantify
yeah.
fatigue and recovery in a much more objective manner.
Yeah.
And then what the implications are of that in the short term, like on that day's training, on that week's training, on that month's training, and then seeing the longer term trends
yeah.
to adjust.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I kind of think that like the next logical progression is the incorporation of tools that didn't exist before. Like obviously, you know, plugging the AI stuff, but the idea of like the ability to monitor things that would be too tedious before and be able to use that data to actually make decisions, because that would become the ultimate in execution, which is going to be the one thing that you can always improve on. Once you understand the principles and the program is the best it can be, then the only next step is incredible execution, right? Is perfect execution of it.
Microchips
and people,
yeah.
Laser cleans and hologram snatches.
All right. Well, yeah, sounds good. Thanks, buddy.
Yep.
Thanks for watching today's episode. Hopefully you gained some new insights from Max and I about, you know, our influences to become the coaches that we are now, and some steps that you can take to help you grow as a coach. As always, share the episode, go on iTunes, leave us a 5-star review, write us something funny or nice. We always appreciate that. Check out roan.com/juglife and pick up some great looking, versatile, functional apparel that you can wear in the gym, at work, wherever you're headed to. And visit jtsstrength.com for all of our online coaching, like Juggernaut AI Powerlifting and Powerbuilding, all our weightlifting options, plus books and Juggernaut apparel. Thanks for watching. We'll see you next week.